Ben is finishing his PhD in the clinical psych program here at the University of Kansas. And Sylvia Hollowell. Sylvia has just completed her master's in social work at KU this spring. And she has spent the last year with a group of women, professionals and non-professionals in the Kansas City area, discussing sexist counseling, how to de-sex their own counseling techniques and be aware of sexual biases and role expectations in their own counseling. She has recently established a private practice here in the Lawrence community and may wish to talk a little bit about that during the program. A Feminist Perspective is brought to you by the Women's Resource and Career Planning Center, located in the Dean of Women's Office, 222 Strong Hall. This resource center has been developed to respond to the special needs of women at this time as they rethink their career expectations and own roles in today's contemporary society. At this time, we have over 400 volumes of books on women, as well as extensive files on career education and career information and opportunities, fellowship and scholarship information for women, graduate catalogs, law school catalogs, med school catalogs, and many other resources that would be helpful to women who are rethinking who they are in today's world. So we invite all women and men by the Women's Resource and Career Planning Center in 222 Strong Hall. But there's a lot to cover in this area. I think in the past few years at the American Psychological Association meetings, as well as many other the professional meetings in the field, the various fields, feminists, very angry women, have spoken out against the kind of therapy and mental health counseling that women have had in the past. The Radical Therapist, a publication of articles by people who are in ways trying to change the mental health profession, has accused psychologists and social workers of being the soft policemen of today's society and building cells out of expectations and roles and shoulds in the case of women. How would you respond to this, and do you feel, have you felt some of this yourself and in your own training? Start wherever you want in responding to that.
I suppose the thing that strikes me first in reference to that issue is probably the necessity of breaking down therapy as it's talked about into a body of theory or knowledge or belief about how people are and how people should be, as well as the kind of social publicity that goes on through the formal and informal voices of psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers, other mental health professionals, to distinguish that somewhat from exactly what goes on within a therapy relationship. I think the sexist and non-sexist attributes of those differ somewhat and probably sometimes get into confusion when people are trying to discuss ways in which to remove themselves from what I personally would see as a negative or policeman role in relationship to people. I guess specifically what I'm thinking of is in my own training and experience, I found it on one level a very painful and yet rewarding experience to find the kind of biases and projections that I come into a relationship with, the kinds of things that I walk into a door and meet another person with, the kinds of values I have about who that person should be, can be, how I can be with them. At the same time, I found it even more frustrating and irritating the kinds of things I see in print, here on the radio, and generally kind of am surrounded by as the general theory of what mental health means, what change means. And I find that, I guess, even more frustrating because I'm not quite as sure how to change that. It's a little easier for me to talk about how to change myself. I find it much more difficult to get in terms of changing the system of beliefs and attitudes people have.
I don't know if this study would refer really to the prison concept that you were talking about, but a couple by the name of Broverman did a study in a Massachusetts mental hospital, which is rather famous along the lines of sex role stereotypes in the mental health profession. And what they found, essentially, in interviewing about 90 different professionals of all persuasions, psychiatrists, psychologists, and social workers, was that there's a double standard of mental health. And they found that, for example, in order to be healthy, women had to be more submissive, less independent, less adventurous, easily influenced, and they the professionals saw that women flew off the handle in minor crises more easily, this kind of thing, so that when a woman sees a professional who believes this kind of double standard, then in order to be healthy, the woman has to be radically different from the man. And in a sense, that is a prison or a cell, and it's a mental cell that the woman finds herself in.
Yeah, certainly if you are different from those expectations, you begin to wonder if you are unhealthy mentally, and that's
right.
A very scary thing.
Right. If you know, if you're an aggressive or adventurous kind of woman, then often if you go into a counseling situation, you'll be made to feel guilty for being like that, for being aggressive or adventurous.
I kind of like to ask a question of both of you. I think that, you know, so many of the older therapists were schooled in the Freudian or the you know, the more traditional theories of psychotherapy. And some of the new things that are coming up, well, they're not really so new, but Gestalt and the awareness groups, I think are really making an honest effort to overcome the kind of stereotyping that you're talking about. Don't you think that a lot of this is really going to change very fast as the younger people come up through these groups and these influences? Because I think so many times what I attribute the stereotyping and the sexist counseling to, or therapy to, is the kind of the old therapies, the old personality theories. And I'm wondering if there isn't really a new thing coming up now that's going to make a big difference. What do you think?
That reminds me of something I was reading just last night, kind of preparing for what I might say today. Along the lines of the encounter and the gestalt and all of that, that what this can do is get men and women together in groups where they become friendly, break down barriers. But there's a certain temporariness or artificiality about these, and that the same kinds of attitudes can go on in encounter groups, you know, where men still treat women as sex objects, and they may be overcoming certain barriers, but it's still not a person-to-person thing, you know, it's not an adult-to-adult interchange. And I don't know, I guess I personally have some, I would question some of that. Some people have read in some of the humanistic psychologies, like Maslow, mm-hmm. and have done some research in really, you know, picking through their writings and found that their writings are also still have that underlying bias against women, or making a large distinction between men and women, an emotional mm-hmm. distinction.
Hmm. Well, I think another thing that would concern me also, I sort of share your optimism that things are really changing. At least these things are being talked about at American Psychological Association meetings and other kinds of meetings, which indicates a huge change from a few years ago. But one of the concerns is that the older therapists and the older people who have developed these theories are in teaching positions, and their students go through, you know, you become a real student of a person with these kinds of theories. And the younger people may move into the therapeutic settings, but not as often into the teaching settings, I don't think. Now, of course, you're mm-hmm. an exception. I mean, you're involved, Diane,
in
training.
In teaching.
In mm-hmm. training counselors. Yeah. And, yeah. You know,
I think the kinds of influences we're talking about must be very, very subtle. Very subtle, because I'm not as aware of them as the three of you are, apparently. But before, you know, when I was preparing for the show, I talked to a number of the members of my department and was trying to grill them about what they would do with certain kinds of problems and so on. And I can't find it. I can't find it. Maybe it's our bureau, maybe it's the people that I work with, but I have a hard time finding what we're talking about there. And yet I know, you know, talk to women clients of mine, and I know that they feel the kinds of pressures you're talking about, the kinds of stereotyping.
One of the things that I think concerns me that was brought to mind when you were asking, you know, our reactions to mm-hmm. some of the new humanistic mm-hmm. and encounter kinds of movements is that my experience in a lot of these groups and in working with a lot of these leaders has been that the personal biases or sets of leaders are often equally as important in determining like the tone of the group and what kinds of interpersonal issues are dealt with as are the more publicized value aspects of what they're doing. For example, I've noticed some leaders always have groups that get into some kinds of sexy encounters. Some leaders always have groups that seem to have angry problems. What concerns me is I haven't met very many leaders who attribute that to their own draw from people, to their own set that they project in terms of what's an acceptable way to be, what's a rewarded way to be in that context. And probably what concerns me most is I really don't see that much attention being given to the specific issue of what function does it have in a relationship if one person's male, one person's female. What effect does that have on the therapy? What effect does that have on the possible goals or changes? And until I see that much more openly ascribed to, you know, by therapists and I suppose by clients, really, because I think it's a two-sided problem, then I can't get real optimistic. You know, I have a little optimism, but not as much as I think maybe you do.
Well, I think maybe the subtlety that I feel is there, and maybe the rest of you see it would be differently, as a woman who feels unhappy and angry, and who thinks she has a problem, who has admitted to it, who said to herself, I have a problem and I'm going to go get some help, goes to a person, and several things can happen. I mean, the anger may be very justified. She may be in a situation which should produce anger. That's, you know, that's a sign of health. And instead, she's told to adjust. She should, you know, get rid of this anger that, and some other kinds of things. And I think that's the kind of subtlety. And she feels very, she's very vulnerable at this point because she's already said she's sick. And he says, and then if the male therapist might say, yes, indeed, you are sick. You know, you need to be content with these certain kinds of roles. For instance, staying at home with children or something, in these kinds of ways.
You know, I think what I respond to and that really kind of react to is I know that there are therapists all over who do say things like that. But a good therapist doesn't say something like, you know, you've got to get rid of your anger or you've got to adjust to these roles. A good therapist lets the client decide what she or he wants to do. They don't go around directing, although, you know, I read things all the time about, and I hear my clients say, well, this person told me to do such and such, and I think, oh, you know, did they really?
Right, or they may have made a lot of assumptions because they were men.
See, I'm wondering if a person goes around saying, you ought to do this, if a therapist goes around saying, you ought to do this, you ought to control your anger, get rid of it, or fit into this role, that person's not a good therapist, period. They wouldn't be a good therapist for a man or for a woman, I don't think, if that's what they do. I don't know, do you agree? Or?
I do agree with that. However, I'm wondering if I think that all therapists or counselors, I really prefer to see myself as a counselor rather than a therapist because I don't really feel that I heal anything. I lost my thought there. A counselor can't help but make their values known to the counselee. It's bound to come across, you know, in conversation, in nonverbal communication. You know, for example, if a male therapist somehow really believes that a woman is more feminine if she wears a miniskirt than slacks. If she usually wears slacks to therapy or to the counseling session, but one day she wears a miniskirt and he says, ah, or you know, he stares at her legs or something like this, then the message comes across. You know, his bias comes across. And so I don't know. I agree, yes, being too directive is not good counseling.
Well, I think that a lot of the anger stems from the old theories that you were referring to earlier, Diana, especially Freudian psychology. And I think in the sort of pop psych culture that is very much a part of today's world, a lot of people feel that this is where psychology is. And there certainly are a lot of people who were trained in that school and are still being trained or, you know, are still studying that kind of thing seriously. Do you feel that the students who come through or the clients who come to you are pushing at the field in this area?
I think that the women that I've seen in the Guidance Bureau are definitely pushing at it. Very definitely.
In terms of asking for changes in the program or just in their own awareness as counselors?
No, in their own... No, I'm talking about my clients rather than the students.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. The clients are pushing for awareness as women and, you know, this kind of thing, very much so. And I'm seeing quite a few women right now.
Do you feel that some of these women are coming to you just because you are the woman in the Guidance Bureau at this time?
Or? Well, they were referred to me by someone else, friends, or in this case, but I think that a number of the people that I see are coming because I'm a woman, yeah. They feel that there is a different perspective there. And I don't know whether this is right or wrong. I mean, true or untrue, but this is their belief. This has been said often enough.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I don't think that it's entirely true. But if this is the belief, you know, this is an important, very important thing.
Yeah. I could respond to that from my own experience. Several years ago, I got some counseling myself and from a male counselor. And now, you know, as I look at my own life, if I were seeking someone... I wouldn't seek a male counselor. Mm-hmm. I think, and maybe that's a certain kind of sexism in reverse, but it's temporary, I feel. I feel that if I were seeking counseling, I would want to talk to a woman simply to get, you know, her feedback about how she feels about the things that, you know, that I've been going through in becoming more aware.
That raises an issue for me that I would like to get some response to, and that's the issue of what sorts of things could we do as therapists to communicate to our clients either directly when they come to us individually or in general, how to find out what kind of counselor they're getting? You know, like part of the old school, I think, that we're all talking about is kind of the bad guys. Part of the concept was the therapist is a blank screen, the therapist's personality does not really affect what goes on within the therapy session. And I think this has been disproven enough in enough different ways that it shouldn't be an issue. But one way in which I feel it is I find a great deal of reluctance on the part of therapists to identify their values openly to clients. To say to a client, you know, I really don't think I can understand you because I'm a man, I'm white, I'm, you know, whatever the variable might be. And again, I see that as a two-way street because I find that clients come to me expecting me to be an expert on everything, and I feel it very difficult to communicate to them sometimes that I really don't understand and that maybe, just maybe, their feeling of not communicating to me might be as much my problem as their problem. And that's something, you know, I would like to find out how you guys feel about that issue and also maybe what we can do about it.
What you're sort of encouraging is for people to shop for counselors or therapists, to like not believe that the counselor has all the answers and is kind of a little god who's omnipotent or omniscient and sees everything.
Right, and that all therapists are the same.
Right, right. I don't know. I think that, for one thing, the profession, people in the profession are going to have to be more honest about that fact, that we don't, you know, see into the mind, we don't have magic. Mm-hmm. And make contracts. I think if I, you know, I really try to establish with the person, you know, why did you come?
Mm-hmm.
If you can you tell me as precisely as possible what you want to do with me, you know, and keep reworking that contract, you know, time after time. If
one thing I would really like to see would be the people in the field really examining their own motives and their own values, because how many people do you know who are in the field who have never been in any kind of counseling or therapy themselves? A lot of people. And not that that's necessarily the only way to examine your values, but we really should. I think a lot of people are just kind of in it blind.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're not even in a position. If the client were to try to establish what the person's values are, I'm not even sure that... I think that would be a very threatening question to an awful lot of people.
Yeah, I think, Doug, you're assuming that we all know what our biases are, so we could tell them to the, you know, to the clients. And I'm not sure, as Diane is, that, you know, as I've gone through some thinking of the women's movement, I keep uncovering things in myself.
Uh-huh.
This month's Ms. Magazine, or last month's Ms. Magazine, had a a picture of a baby on the cover with a bow in the hair. And as you read, you found out that this was a boy baby, you know. But immediately I made the assumption, and I'm sure many people did, that this was a little girl baby. And just on lots and lots of levels, there's these little cues that you key off on and make some decisions about who that person is out of. And so I think it's a kind of constant process, really. A good counselor would need to be in a constant process with other counselors, perhaps the kind of thing that you've been doing, Sylvia.
And I think that the client provides maybe the best, you know, if you're really open, and the client is such a challenge always to you to keep reappraising your own values. And, you know, if you're really open and you don't, if you try not to operate out of a closed system, the client, I think that my clients this year have been fantastic in making me grow.
Yeah, I think it's a good point. Both of those seem very good points to me, because I know 3 or 4 years ago, it never would have occurred to me to consider that I couldn't work with a woman because she was a woman. And it took a lot of personal experiences, some of which I think are what you're talking about, Diane, of clients proving to me that I really did have blind spots. Other of them involving things like being in a men's liberation group to find out what some of my biases were, talking with other people who were trying to fight the same battles in terms of coming up with a system of beliefs that fit for what they wanted to do. And I guess I also agree that I don't see that happening, you know, like you say, Janet, often enough for most people to be able to say, here's the kind of therapist I am, you know, label me. I'm a feminist counselor. I'm a whatever the label might be that someone feels really describes them to the client.
Yeah, I think in the shopping around idea, you're always going to find a counselor with his own or her own set of biases. Mm-hmm. Just being aware of what they are would be the important thing, and being able to disclose some of those to the client. They wouldn't necessarily have to then leave and seek another counselor, but at least they would be aware, you know, also a little bit on guard with you, that these are some of your biases, because we're all going to have them. You know, they can't shop around and find an unbiased counselor in that sense. I think that the training programs that are producing counselors, be they the master's in social work programs or the other programs here on campus, you do see some struggling within those programs, sometimes on behalf of the students outside of the classroom, to rework some of these ideas. I think the point where it's really much harder to do is when you're actually involved in a daily job in a counseling setting, to provide the time for yourself with other counselors to keep up this kind of personal growth. Once you've left the academic setting, you're supposed to have sort of arrived.
You don't feel like that. That's when you start really, really growing, I think.
But do you feel that has been built in for you, Diane, or that's something that's just sort of happened out of your own initiative? Or would it be possible not to have rethought a lot of these things?
I don't think, considering the clients I've had this last year, that it would have been possible, for me at least, not to have experienced all of those people and not grown a tremendous amount, really. It's been fantastic. But we don't talk as much as I think we should, and maybe we will, about our own personal values. Again, it's a question of time.
Well, and I think anyone who's counseling in the setting of a university community is being pushed a little more by their clients than perhaps they would be in your setting, Doug, where the client may be a little more in awe of your educational attainment and a little bit disadvantaged in relationship to you in education, and not feeling as comfortable to push against you. I think that would happen more in welfare departments and community mental health agencies and family and children's service agencies, where the clientele may be a little different in terms of having thought out some of these things themselves.
Yeah, I think that makes me think of something that has frustrated me time and time again, as I felt like I wanted very much to like radicalize a group of people that I was experiencing contact with, and that was to find like how, even though people have been victimized in a social learning sense, you know, like we talk, I think, about women learning that they are one down in any kind of relationship with a man, even though people learn that, you know, they very soon take it on and make it part of themselves and actively maintain it. And I guess that to me is related to what you mentioned, Jan, because I find even when I go into a session with someone and try very hard to communicate directly and indirectly how I see myself, that oftentimes what has brought those people there is much ambivalence and much behavior that is relating to me as though I were an expert.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How do you dispel them? Do you have any? I mean, sometimes you can't just come out and say, well, you can't tell the client, I don't know anything. You cannot say that. How do you demystify yourself?
That's a good question. I found sometimes sharing similar experiences I've had communicates that I know what it feels like. Sometimes simply saying directly that I don't know works. I guess less often than I would like. I think you're right there. For me, that's something I'm really struggling with a lot, and I don't have an answer. That's something I would really like to be more comfortable with, was how to demystify what I do. I think what you're doing has a lot of interesting implications, because I think there are a lot of ways in which the settings, both physical, the buildings we're in, and the labels we present ourselves to our clients with go a long way in either mystifying or demystifying. Sometimes I feel like that because I am in what is considered a mental health center, that rings all sorts of bells for people that don't often fit with what I think is relevant for that particular person. Have you found it less of a problem now that you're doing private work?
I'm just getting into my office, which is in a house. It's a room, and there are other things going on in the house. It's a kind of a community service center here in Lawrence, and it's church-related. So I think that the house is owned by a church, and I think that being in a house, and I don't use the labels of mental health. I don't see them as mental problems. They're problems in living that people bring, and I have problems in living. We all do. And I see myself as contracting with people to work specifically on problems, and I think that that will help. I spent some time at the same clinic that you're at, and I think that has a lot to do with it, the physical setting and the labels.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard for me to say because I'm not really that much into what I'm doing yet, but I'll report to you in 6 months.
Well, it's time for us to take a station break, and we'll come back later to discuss the problems of women seeking mental health counseling and therapy in this community and from the profession at large. So join us again in a moment for A Feminist Perspective. Welcome back to A Feminist Perspective. We're discussing the problems of women seeking mental health counseling with Dr. Diane Kelly from the Guidance Bureau, Doug Witt from the Burt Nash Community Mental Health Center, and Sylvia Hollowell, who has recently established a private practice in Lawrence and has worked with the problems of women professionals trying to de-sex their own counseling techniques. We'd like to invite you at this time, if you have any questions or comments you would like to share with any of us, to call 864-4530. We'll listen to your question live and attempt to respond to it. So if you have any questions that you would like to share with us, call 864-4530. Sylvia, I wish you would share a little bit with us some of the things you've been doing over the past year with the women professionals. How did you get together, and did you feel some of these things weren't covered in your training and this was an out-of-classroom experience you set up for yourselves, or what was the motivation behind it?
Well, it's definitely out of classroom. It wasn't associated with the school here. Two social workers in Kansas City actually started the group. They just contacted some women professionals, psychologists, social workers, and also other women they knew that would be interested in the whole area of psychology and the mental health professions, even though they weren't professionals. And we had an all-day meeting on a Saturday, and brainstormed about every issue that we could think of. And from there, we are in the process of developing a referral service in the Lawrence, Kansas City area.
Well, we can talk a little bit about this in a moment. Right now, we have a phone call from one of our listeners. Hello?
Yes, hello. I am calling for the simple reason that many people in the industry are not associated with university functions, hence women's lib or anything else. And I found an excellent book on the market that discusses not only psychotherapy, but all the other aspects of women.
And selecting a counselor. We're also going to be doing some things helping lay people, teaching people who haven't been through professional training programs some basic skills in counseling. And if it's okay with the counselee, these people can sit in on counseling sessions and learn some of the skills. We're very open, we hope, non-hierarchical group. And those are some of the things we hope, you know, that it'll branch out. Maybe we'll write a book.
What do you feel this was helpful, a helpful addition to your own training?
Oh, yes, yeah, definitely. I don't think that if I hadn't gotten involved in this group, I probably wouldn't have done some of the research that I've done this year in the literature. I wouldn't have thus grown personally. I feel like it's all kind of gone together to bring me to the point, you know, I am. I probably wouldn't be doing the counseling I'm doing now if it hadn't been for some of these contacts.
Doug, you mentioned that in the past few years that you had been part of a men's liberation group.
Uh-huh.
Were these men from the counseling field? And
most of the people were involved in the clinical psych program that I was in. We had a few people who were friends, and I think in a sense what you're describing is as maybe lay psychologists, in other words, people who were very interested in the idea of developing human potential, utilizing groups to try to get to a basis of what we brought to a relationship that might get in the way of our own personal growth and our ability to relate to others. I was really struck by what the caller mentioned in terms of the female orientation of much of the liberation writings and talkings. I became aware of that, I think, when I first got interested in what women's liberation as a movement and a philosophy had to say to me. And I discovered it was quite a bit later that I started thinking about what was involved for me as a man and as an individual. In some ways, I think it's very similar and very direct. I think something that's become quite openly discussed, which is the thing that if you really believe that sex roles are inhibiting, then one person's gain is bound to be another's gain.
Mm-hmm.
But I think even more directly for me, I discovered a lot of ways in which I had a great deal of difficulty relating to other men because of some of the perceptions I had of what was expected of me, what was drawn for me in that context, that was in some ways a completely different issue for me than what happened between me and a woman. And something I really hadn't spent much time looking at. That's something I guess I'm very glad to see happening and changing somewhat now.
And Diane, in your program that you're affiliated with, in the counselor, training of counselors, a lot of them for secondary education roles, I think one of the most striking things I remember in the past year was a film called Growing Up Female. Has six become one? A film done by a feminist from Antioch College, showing a high school counselor reading to a young woman the attributes of a good wife. And I think, of course, this is the kind of thing that that I'm sure where many places are not into anymore, but certainly there are a lot of counselors in schools who maybe would be in this sort of soft policeman role of laying out mm-hmm. some expectations to a very vulnerable age in terms of peer acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see a lot of people going out into the secondary education field now with different ideas about what men and women's roles might be?
Oh, that's really kind of a difficult question. The people that I see, I think, the people in our practicum that I'm working with and that I know, I think would never do something like that. But again, it's difficult to tap into a person's really fundamental stereotypes or values, and perhaps we should do much more of that, really. I really can't say no or yes. I hope that we're turning people out who are for people's liberation, you know, freeing everyone up, really.
Mm-hmm.
I think many of the young women in high schools now are would be pushing against counselors also. I know in the high school here there's a women's liberation group, and I'm sure some of those women would push against any kind of counselor who tried to hold up an expectation of your, as a woman, you will be a good wife, and here's some of the things you should be in this way.
We have a tremendous number of women in the master's program, and a number of women doctoral students too. And now I know quite a few of those women, and I know that they are definitely going out with a very different kind of idea than that which is described in that film. But I think most of the men are too, really. The ones that I know are, insofar as we've been able to challenge their beliefs. And this is something we do really try to keep a good eye out for.
In some of the counseling that marital problems related to marital problems that that a couple might seek, do you find them asking for one sex or the other, or women who don't feel comfortable with a male therapist, or maybe the necessity of co-counseling where a man and woman are both represented to sort of empathize and affirm the feelings of the other person? Do you see much of this being done in the field, and do you think this is a healthy sign, or do you feel that people will respond to this kind of request for a male and female counselor, especially in marital problems?
I'm for it, for a male and female counselor seeing a couple. I haven't done any of it yet, and I'm not aware of a lot of it in the field. Probably the most famous couple is the Masters and Johnson Clinic in St. Louis, which does primarily counseling around sexual problems and sexual dysfunctions. But I think that I know the social welfare school does not, as far as I know, have any focus on, you know, training joint counseling, joint counselors. But I think it's a good thing.
We have done this on a number of occasions in the Guidance Bureau this last year, and I've done this with several people with another male counselor, and it's very. I think it's a very good thing to do. A lot of things come out, you know, when you have both sexes represented, and you've got, it's really a foursome, you know.
Did the clients ask for this kind of therapy, or
on a couple of occasions, yes, and on some other occasions, we have just suggested that this might be a good thing to do. Well, always it's the clients, you know, they are ready for it.
Mm-hmm.
But this is something that we're very open to doing, and it's really been. It's been very, I think it's been very successful what we've done so far.
Doug, how about in the Burt Nash Clinic?
I've just been working at Burt Nash a short time. My impression is there is a great deal of endorsement of the value of co-therapy, and I think a great deal of realization that the sex of the therapist is an important consideration in making up like a co-therapist team. One of the problems that we've run into has been the economics. We find, and I'm sure a lot of people working in this field do, that we have a phenomenal number of people coming to the center asking for some kind of counseling, and it becomes very expensive for us to have two therapists for a couple or for an individual. Probably the compromise that often comes up would be like a couples group run by a male and female therapist. I find, like I say, a great deal of endorsement of the value of it. Putting it into practical, you know, effective use has been a lot harder.
Well, I think that many of the marital problems that are presenting themselves, as well as many of the problems that men are now bringing to therapy, relate to the new rethinking and role orientation that they're struggling with, a reaction to an angry woman that they're living with, perhaps, mm-hmm. or trying to understand why someone that loves them is also so angry with them, you know, and some of these kinds of things. So I think that as men seek counseling too, that this will definitely be a phenomenon. There are probably some men who could not be counseled by a woman at this point because of some of the personal hassles that they're having. I don't know if you've had any men who come to you, Doug, who would like to talk in this area.
It's interesting. There are very few people I've run into at Burt Nash who have stated sex as a preference. That happened much more at KU in the psych clinic when I was there. Again, I think related to some of the things we've talked about of when you have a population come to you that's very verbal and very aware of some of these issues, they're more likely to bring it up.
I don't know. For me, that's a very interesting question, the whole idea of how much
does the sex of the therapist get in the way of a person's ability to talk or to grow in the directions they're interested in. And it's an issue I guess I'm very uncertain about. I have gone through periods of feeling very definitely that there should not be a male seeing a female client and vice versa. I don't feel that way as strongly right now. Some of the reason being that I have found much less difference in the way that males and females project their sexual bias into the relationship. That doesn't make me as secure about saying that if I see a man, I'm really going to be able to help him in a sex role free way, and vice versa, you know, for women. In some ways, I think that a crucial issue is that it does make it less difficult for the client to deal with the client's problems and not deal with the therapist's problems. That is something I have a personal faith in, that there's something about the tension and the power relation that often happens when a man and woman get together that it is much harder to overcome than those same issues that come up between men and between women. But like I say, I have also been surprised at how often I see female therapists laying a very heavy sex role trip on a woman client and male therapists laying a very heavy trip on their men of, you've got to act like a man, you know, let's go out there and play baseball together, and this is their approach to therapy.
Mm-hmm. I think, like you indicated earlier, so much does depend on the counselor herself or himself, and the orientation and where that person is really at, because certainly some women are very very traditional in their viewpoint, and would, I mean, like, you know, just going to a woman does not ensure that you're going to have non-sexist mm-hmm. counseling at all. Certainly not all women support the, you know, the women's movement. They're very threatened by it. So I think in shopping for a counselor, you'd have to be careful and ask, know the right questions and ask the right questions. I would still rather take my chances, though, that, you know, perhaps a woman would understand more readily some of the struggles mm-hmm. That a woman faces.
I think the idea that your referral group has is very interesting, of asking the counselor to disclose a little bit about their values. And that relates to what we were talking about earlier, not every counselor being in touch with what their values are. But at least, you know, that in some ways gets past the sex thing, because I feel that ultimately we would like for people to choose counselors as persons who they think would understand their hassles and mm-hmm. and not on the basis of sex, because as you were saying, Sophie, that doesn't necessarily mean you're getting a certain kind of counselor either. Mm-hmm. That may be the kind of expectation that many people bring to you, Diane, in the guidance bureau, that you're a woman, and so they're there because they assume you're going to have certain ideas about the women's movement.
Some of the women do. Some of the women just assume that because I'm a woman, that I therefore, you know, the other way. Mm-hmm. And some of the men come in, I think, with the expectations that I'm going to be a big sister or a mother, you know, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. I'm kind of curious, what kinds of questions would you suggest that a woman ask? Have you formulated that yet out of the work that you've been doing? Because I imagine a lot of the listeners would probably like to know what they should ask.
Yeah, when I said that, I thought, you know, that's sort of...
I started to develop a while back a questionnaire, just a general questionnaire that would get at what sex role stereotypes were all about. Like, I don't know how you would get at the values of the therapist. Let's see, if I were seeking a non-sexist counselor, I guess I would ask them... you know, what do you think feminine is? You know, what do you have to do to be a feminine person or a masculine person? And, you know, if I were coming to you, for example, Diane, as a counselor, I would say, you know, what do you think feminine is? What do you think masculine is? And based on your answer, I would make some assessment mm-hmm. about where you were at on that. You know, if you said, well, men are aggressive and women cry easily and, you know, things like that, I would probably say, well, I don't think she's for me. That would be one question that immediately comes to mind. I think there would be a lot of them. And perhaps what listeners could do would be do some thinking, you know, on their own about, you know, pushing their own thoughts. What kinds of questions could you ask a counselor?
Do you think that many counselors would respond? I'm thinking that usually in a professional relationship, when you go in as to a physician or a lawyer or a counselor or anything, you don't really, the opportunity is not built in, and you may be able to create it for yourself. The opportunity is not presented to you to find out a little bit about that person.
Yeah, this is, I have very strong feelings about this because I think this is one of the real failings of the profession. We were talking about this earlier. And I don't think that clients need to be intimidated by counselors. You know, the client is the consumer. You're paying for the service of the counselor. If you go to an attorney, you're paying for the service. If you go to an IRS, an income tax person, you pay for the service. I think you have every right to ask the counselor to clarify their position. And if they won't, then maybe they're not a, you know, good counselor. I mean, it seems like a person ought to be willing as a counselor to say what their values are and what they think masculine and feminine is. That's not a loaded question. It's an honest question.
It is. I think that the person asking that question should probably make it clear that they're not certain that they want to get in this kind of relationship with this person yet, and they want to know the answers to these questions. For that very reason, because if they just came in and said, "What do you think feminine is?" I imagine a counselor might turn around and say, "What does it mean to you?"
right.
You're having a problem with
that? Right. This is always putting it back on the client. It's a very angering.
It would make me angry.
Mm-hmm. Clients have asked me some things personally about myself, and I think that's their attempt to determine whether I'm someone that they can talk to. So when I say I'm single and I have children, this sometimes I think is sufficient or frees them up to do that. Mm-hmm. Maybe finding out something, just something personally about the counselor, the therapist, would help.
Mm-hmm. And we don't really build that in, that opportunity in, I think.
It's very
difficult. It would take a person with a certain amount of aggression to be able even to do that much.
Mm-hmm.
I think anyone who's ever gone into a physician's office from some of the other place, I mean, we all know how we feel and how out of place that kind of questioning might seem.
And in our training, you know, we're told to keep yourself personally out of it. And so we're really trained in the opposite direction.
Two things occur to me in relation to that. One is, it's too bad that we don't, as part of training, do some like role reversal things and sit in the position of a client and also as a therapist trying to figure out like how to handle situations like that. What kinds of questions, you know, would I like to ask if I was having a therapist? I haven't really thought that much about that. The other thing that occurs to me is, I wonder if maybe part of the answer to this questions clients could ask therapists couldn't come through if there was a development of openness and community among people outside of therapy to talk about their experiences, to talk about the reputation different therapists have. I think this is something that's becoming a little bit more acceptable, is for people to talk openly and honestly with friends about what kind of problems they're having, what kind of experiences they're having, which I could see doing two things. One thing is it might help some people decide what they really need is a good friend to talk to, and they don't need to go to a therapist, which I think is often therapeutic in itself, you know, to make that decision. But also they might pick up on, you know, a good friend of mine had a great experience with so-and-so, and this is why. That might be a very good source of data and actually give better information than if you made the appointment and tried, in 5 minutes to ask direct questions to get at what is, in essence, a kind of behavior that therapists probably aren't aware of. You know, if somebody asked me what my biases are, the problem is that what they're really going to want to know are the things I don't know.
Well, we're coming to the end of our program. I think that that one of the things that I'm seeing in the Women's Resource and Career Planning Center is people doing just this, what you're saying. They come to our office thinking that we will have heard of other women who've had successful experiences with certain counselors and asking for a referral to someone who might be comfortable with some of the ideas of the women's movement that are very important to them right now and they want to explore in counseling with some of the problems they're having. And a sort of grapevine does develop, which might be more fair in terms of what you say, rather than just a capsulized moment, but in terms of how someone's been treated, because certainly good counseling, as you were saying earlier, there's some just good counseling techniques which might rise above this. In some cases, a person may respond
to something that they feel very personally about what masculine and feminine is, but they could be accepting of other kinds of actions on behalf of other people that they're not so personally related to, perhaps. So I think that might begin to develop. I know women singers around the country are developing lists of doctors, of lawyers to help in divorce cases, and therapists and all kinds of professional services where a woman with ideas of the women's movement might feel more comfortable. Well, I want to thank Dr. Diane Kelly, Sylvia Hollowell, and Doug Witt for being with us this evening and discussing the problems of women in the mental health field and women seeking the services of those in the mental health field. Next week, our program will be on Our Bodies, Ourselves, the attempt of women to learn more about their bodies and more about the medical services that they are receiving at this time. I invite you again to stop by the Women's Resource and Career Planning Center in 222 Strong Hall, and to explore some of the resources that we have there and talk with any of the staff about some of your ideas, career aspirations, goals, returning to school after an absence, or anything else that is on your mind. So thank you for joining us for A Feminist Perspective, and we hope you'll tune in again next week.